Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 14th, 2005. Today's session is Practicing Our Faith Workshop, presented by Dorothy Bass in the Creekside Room.
My name is Dorothy Bass, and I'm here at Holden all summer as the coordinator of the teaching staff. And when I'm back home, I direct a project which really is hosting a conversation on the shape and character of faithful Christian living in our time. And it's been a very collaborative project, which began, kind of came onto the public scene with the publication of our first book, Practicing Our Faith, which many of you may know. I wrote the title up there. This was published in 1997. One of the other authors with me was Larry Rasmussen, whom most of us heard last night. They were 13 of us all together. And from there, the conversation has expanded out into other communities. We worked together later on a similar book for teenagers written by youth and adults together. And the conversation has been collaborative at every stage, and I'm grateful to all of you for being here. And I see this as one more opportunity to expand the conversation about what it means to live faithfully and how we can help one another to do that in a time of exceptional global change and distress. Okay? So we'll be expanding this. And the way we're going to go about this, I'm going to make a few opening remarks, especially to, I hope, focus on the idea of a way of life. And then ask three people who have taken ideas in the project and developed them in their own ways, in their own situations, to share what they've done, to show how it can become concrete in specific communities. And then open it up. Okay? Now, in this whole conversation, we've worked with the idea of practices as a way to talk about our way of life. I'll tell you, this is a really complex phrase, a term, practices, very complex. And we're going to work more on that on Thursday, okay, with an exercise that we'll do together on Thursday. So as I said today, I want to kind of back up and focus on the way of life that practices together comprise, and also to look at some specific efforts in specific communities. And I often start when I do sessions like this with a story which actually is in Practicing Our Faith, but still says it to me better than most other stories. And that's of a dinner table conversation I had probably 10 years ago in Valparaiso with a Catholic priest and a very observant Jewish law professor. And we were at table after the, after the priest had spoken. And the two of them started talking, and the priest said to the Keith said to Sai, our Jewish law professor, you know, I have to tell you about this time I was in Israel, and I got to Jerusalem on Friday afternoon, and took the bus into the city, and when I was halfway to where I was going, Shabbat began, the buses closed down, and I picked up my suitcase and started walking. And I was walking on, wondering, it was starting to get dark, and I passed a home, and a family said, what's going on? Well, I said, I'm traveling. I don't know how to get to my place. They said, come in. It's evening. It's Shabbat. Stay with us. Tomorrow, our child will be our son will be bar mitzvah. We need a guest. So he went in. So they had a wonderful time. He participated and received their hospitality happily. And at the end of Shabbat on Saturday afternoon, the buses started running again. He got on his bus and went on his way. Okay. And at this point, the Jewish law professor says, well, that's really amazing because, you know, when I was a college student long-haired, late 60s, I was hitchhiking around Europe, And I came to a little village in Spain late one night, got off the train, and there I was, just abandoned. The village was completely shut down, but I saw a light off in the darkness, and I walked towards it, and it turned out to be a monastery. And I knocked on the door, they let me in, they gave me a place to stay, they received me graciously, and the next morning they put me on the train again. And so it was kind of this reciprocal stories of hospitality. Now, it seems to me in our society, many people hearing these stories would think, random acts of kindness, right? Random acts of kindness. And I'm all for kindness wherever it comes. But these were far from random acts. These were acts that were embedded in a way of life. Both of these communities, the Jewish household and the monastery, had been, in a sense, they had been practicing what they would do when a stranger came along. Throughout their whole lives, they've been practicing. They've been getting ready for this guest, not knowing who it would be, but they've been getting ready. And they've been getting ready, not only kind of spiritually, shall we say, but they had a bed. They had some soup. They had the time, right? They had arranged their common life in such a way that they had the time. In fact, time shaped the first story of hospitality, the one that's a Shabbat. They had arranged their communities in such a way as to divide up the labor. Okay? They had, and this is important, they had been having conversations with words also about what they would do when a stranger came to the door. Right? They could tell you stories that are 3,000 years old about strangers. I mean, their way of life, in a sense, and the practices in which they engaged were clothed. They had garments of language and reflections. Make sense? Mm-hmm. So, moreover, they weren't just, even though they were ancient in that sense, they weren't just sitting there passed on unchanged from one generation to the next. They change along the way, as needed, to perhaps to fulfill their full vibrancy within a certain, perhaps to overcome distortions that have crept in of prejudice or of, perhaps they change. There is a tradition of reflection on this practice in both of those communities. But I did a homily last week on bare feet, on take off your shoes, and encountered and included in the homily a story of how the Benedictines in former times washed the feet of every, Benedict instructed his community to wash the feet of every stranger who came. And why? Not to track in dust, perhaps. But also, in Benedict's knowledge, that in the doing of certain things, they would see the world in a different way. And they would see the stranger in a different way. In the doing, we develop ways of seeing the world, right? Develop ways of seeing one another. Isn't that true? And Nancy Easland yesterday in the same room was talking about how our theology really is embodied in our practices, much more than in abstract doctrines that we can print on the page, but that we never really figure out how to out. Okay? And I think there's a real important place for doctrine in all of this, but the way in which we actually are formed to see the world and to think, what is it that I really need as a person? What am I called on to risk? Who am I really? I mean, that comes out as we live a way of life, right? And these different communities had a sense of that, which they fostered and cultivated across the generations. Tell your way of life story.
Yeah.
Just as an image of this.
Yeah, I lived at a Christian community in Durham, North Carolina, called the Rootba House, and our house is in a neighborhood that's kind of economically depressed, and so you have folks who hang out off the streets there, and there's this one guy named Andre who I hadn't seen for a while, so not too long ago I saw him standing out there, and so I called him by name and said, how you been doing? And he says to me, you want to talk about theology, don't you? And I said, well, I love to talk about theology. What's on your mind? He says, I'm a Muslim because Islam is about how you live. Christianity is about what you believe in your heart, but Islam is about how you live. And I said, that's it. You know, I mean, I think that's what this whole project is about, helping Christians to see that our faith is really about how we live.
Thank you, and I really agree. At the same time, you want to say, and one of our books on practicing theology, which is up in the bookstore, does this, that you know, our beliefs always come back to criticize how we live, right? Because it's real easy to slip into patterns. I mean, habits are formative and important, but if they're bad habits, oops.
Yeah.
Right? And even among Christians, that can happen. Especially among Christians, I don't know. Okay. But also, I think that in how we live, our beliefs become more believable. Yeah. I mean, I do believe that here I had a very bad week of Sabbath keeping here at Holden. I'll get back to it. But, you know, I do think that stopping the rat race, you know, stepping off the treadmill of work and spend on one day a week, helps us to believe what we sort of know we're supposed to believe but don't really believe, which is that we are not the ones who keep the world turning, you know, which is that God is the one who opposes slavery in every form, okay? So our beliefs become more plausible and become part of us and woven into our flesh, I think, when we live some of the practices that are associated with those very same beliefs. Okay. Let's see. All right. Now, we can leave this to later, but the Holden Village has a way of life, right? Which is far from ideal, but which is at least reflected upon by those of us in ministry over periods of time. And every once in a while, we just abolish a certain, you know, this isn't going well. Let's alter this practice in a certain way. Okay. That's one of the things I enjoy about participation here in this village. One more preliminary comment. The whole idea that we're practicing doesn't mean that we've got everything right. It means we're still practicing. Like, your Catholics use this word a lot. Are you a practicing Catholic? Yeah, always, you know, practicing. Okay, just getting ready. There's a certain sense of rehearsal to our way of life. One of the phrases that has been helpful to me in thinking about all this is to say that in a sense, in practicing our faith, we are participating with our lives in an embodied wisdom. We're embodying the wisdom of our tradition, say, about strangers. Wisdom is interesting also as a phrase. Actually, the theologian David Ford suggested it to us as a strong theme, which we have not previously named. The idea of a transgenerational community that's on a search for wisdom, which it acknowledges in that God is so mysterious and so great, will never be utterly complete, and yet has an urgent hunger always to enter more deeply into God's world and into relationship with one another. So wisdom. And wisdom also is a kind of a transgenerational notion where you listen to the elders, but the youngsters stir up new controversies all the time, and there's a sense of seeking the good always in new circumstances that adheres in that notion of wisdom. In Christian communities, this wisdom is infused with a yearning to embody a way of life that both reflects God's active presence in and for the world, and that also responds to the grace of God as we know it in Christ. Now, the examples I've just given, the Jewish household, let's say in the 1960 in Jerusalem, the Jewish household, a Benedictine monastery in Spain a generation or two ago, and even Holden now, are relatively isolated and remote. and cannot, I think they can help us get some concepts straight, but they're not necessarily, this, very, they're very likely not the same kinds of communities we live in at home, right? Where things are much more mobile and fragmented, where, you know, where you're working with different people that you live with, and, you know, different kinds of values prevail in different realms of life. There's a lot more fragmentation. And so the real challenge becomes, how do we help people to think about their lives in that kind of situation? And I think that oftentimes in each community, we look for points of leverage. You know, where are some places where we could actually get in there, engage with some things that people, that are close to the heart of what people are yearning for, and practice with them. You know? And I think that's what we've done. Last week, our theme, we did some wonderful sessions with Dan Erlander and Larry Rasmussen on the theme Standing on Holy Ground. We're especially thinking about the environment. And Larry rephrased our text from take off your shoes, you're standing on holy ground, to take off your Air Nikes, you're standing on holy real estate. Which says a little something about the character of the way of life, which is being promoted by strong interests within the global economy. What I sometimes think of as lifestyles of abundance, that have invaded the imagination of even those who are very poor, as compared to a way of life that is abundant in what matters more, in justice and mercy and relationship. I think that, you know, in the face of what Larry kept calling the largest human and most powerful human construct ever, the global economy, you know, where do we find places of leverage, places where we can work on, you know, think about our way of life and try to be more deliberate and intentional in entering in responding to God's grace in the way that we live on a daily basis. And sometimes that just happens in a small project. You know, there's a place of beginning, or sometimes, you know, we do it in other ways. Often this happens in local congregations, where the language is there, where worship, I think, embodies some of these practices, where we get an image of how to eat together in our eating together at the table, for example. And that's what we'll be talking about on Thursday. The project has been seeking out thoughtful practitioners, you know, around the country. We've built a lot of partnerships with and been able to support some good work among people who are practicing, trying to think about the way of life and how to live it more abundantly in local situations, and how to pass it on to youth and to work with the congregations to build that up. And about eight or so of those partners are in the village with us this bunch of, just for those who, just if you're one of those, everybody who came here with the Valparaiso Project, just, you know, okay. And then others, and John, you have been at other times too, then done some work with Opera Ministries on this. So, because this is not an abstract, but rather a concrete and fairly down-to-earth approach to Christian life, we asked Bree, just to talk about your own efforts to build up more faithful ways of life in your own communities. Is that the question you were anticipating? No. Okay. Good. So, in whatever, why don't we just go right down, okay, down the list here and tell us about your own work.
Okay. Well, I'm Kirsten Peachey, and I am from Chicago, Illinois. I work for a big health system in the Chicago area called Advocate Healthcare, which was a merger between a Lutheran system and a UCC-related system about 10 years ago. So two faith-based organizations, health organizations, with pretty strong roots into their congregational beginnings, came together to make Advocate Healthcare. And so this tradition, or this this commitment, I guess, to continuing to be in relationship with congregations has continued to be a part of Advocate's mission and sense of identity. So I work with Advocate in congregational health partnerships. So I work with faith communities all around the metropolitan Chicago area that are interested in exploring how they can be more fully places of health and healing, and do that in a number of different ways, through a lot of kind of consultation and education, a lot of partnership development, linking Advocate programs and resources with congregations, and then also seeking some grant funding for very specific projects that work with specific communities around particular issues. You may or may not be aware that there's a whole big health ministry movement that's going on around the country and also internationally. Parish nursing is a big part of that, started by a Lutheran pastor near Westburg, actually out of the Lutheran end of the health system that is now Advocate. And then lots of other people are involved with this health ministry work, as it's called. And my experience of it has been that it's still very driven by kind of a medical model of health, and a medical model of how you intervene related to health. And so there's a lot of the health ministry work that's being done is, kind of health fairs, diabetes education, kind of preventive health kinds of stuff, stress reduction, those kinds of things. And part of what I'm interested in doing is trying to find ways to kind of help congregations see that what they're already doing, what they're already about, is full and rich in terms of the work of wholeness and healing, and that there's so much already there. We don't have to go somewhere else to figure out how to do this. And actually, another book that I draw on quite a bit is a book that some of you may be familiar with or may be interested in, called Deeply Woven Roots by Gary Gunderson from the Interfaith Health Program in Atlanta, where he talks about the strengths of congregations.
Yes, yes.
The strength of the congregation to pray and to bless, to connect people, to accompany people. These are functions of congregations that are happening all the time, and it's actually in these very basic things that we do with each other that's where the congregation has the potential to be a leader, really, in creating a whole new way that we are with each other, and that really kind of recognizes that relationship is at the heart of our wellness. So anyway, that's sort of background to what my specific project is, which was Advocate being a health system identifies priority areas for community outreach kind of work, for the working with communities around health. And one of the priority areas was issues related to obesity and overweight, since those are really having major impact on health in our country. And so I began thinking about how, from a congregational health perspective, we might be able to address the issues of how we eat as a society. And this fits just so well with the faith practices, where most of the curricula that I found, or most of the programs that I found that had a religious connection or a spiritual connection, were very individualistic. My body, my food, my God, kind of thing. And I was interested in the much sort of tapping into the much broader tradition, Christian tradition that we have, that could inform how we eat and how we eat as a way of life. And so really, it's not anything new for people that hang around here at Holden, because it's all the stuff you guys talk about here. But what we did was we were able to use the grant funds to hire a writer who wrote a really wonderful curriculum for us called Just Eating, Practicing Our Faith at the Table. And it's a 7-week program for congregations to work through, either on a Christian education program on a Sunday morning, or during a Lenten series, or Wednesday evening, or whatever way the particular congregation might work. And so we have a leader's guide that has the sessions all outlined, and then a participant book where people do some reflective reading during the week in between the sessions. And our topic areas are, the first one is food sharing as sacramental. So really grounding kind of the sense of eating in the tradition we have as Christians of what it means to gather around the table together. Nurturing the body and kind of exploring our various traditions related to that. Hunger is the next one. Food in the environment, creating community, and then the last one is discerning God's call. Okay, so, you know, what does all this mean for us and where are we going to go from here, sort of thing. That's what we came up with. We also partnered with Church World Service, which some of you may be familiar with. They do a lot of work with hunger and international relief work and that kind of thing, disaster relief. And then the Presbyterian Church, the Presbyterian Hunger Program, got interested in the project, and they ended up designing it and publishing it and are distributing it. So it's available through the Presbyterian Distribution Service.
So, great. Thank you. We can take I'll keep my eye on the watch, but a few minutes for questions or about that if you wish.
Do you talk in interrogation about illnesses related to food, like anorexia?
That would be probably in the honoring the body or nurturing the body part of it, and we didn't really get into that too much. One of our advisory council people also raised that, but that was something that we didn't explore too much. The whole eating disorder. Sort of the larger umbrella of eating disorder, not just obesity, but also sort of how we are estranged from food in lots of other ways. That's a good question.
Did you incorporate like social issues like poverty? The only thing they sometimes have are chips to eat. Mm-hmm. So that's obesity. But the underlying causes are systemic causes,
right?
May not be what they can afford. Can you talk a little bit?
There's a lot in here about. It's not. This is not a diet book, okay? I mean, it's not. It's not meant to be something that you follow in order to lose weight. And we were very clear about that. And so let me be clear that that's not. You know, because if I emphasized obesity, it's not. Because that's not what this book is meant to do. It is meant to explore some of the structural and some of the issues around justice and food and how we can, and one of the things that came back repeatedly from our pilot of it was that, oh, this really helped me to eat more intentionally so that I understand that while I may eat abundantly, others don't, and that there are lots of reasons why that is, and that, you know, that that's also related to me. And that it affects me, and the way I eat affects other people.
I was wondering if it helped anything with kind of the issue of, and this was something that we had a conversation with this morning regarding families and family time around the table. We were talking about the sacramental aspect, and if we don't start in our own homes, where does it start? The whole issue of how it's so easy to fragment and we're all in our own separate space eating for convenience and quickness, you know, get it done,
right.
Get on to the next activity, but never kind of slowing down and interacting with one another. And I think there's been lots of studies on children in particular who are raised in homes where there was this kind of almost sacramental aspect to the dinner table.
Speaking of family.
Actually, sit around the table and talk.
Right.
And hear what your child's day is like and how difficult that is.
Right, yeah. Yeah.
It's an important aspect of eating.
Right.
That we don't think of too often.
Susan's going to, the whole thing on Thursday is going to be on Thursday. Okay, as an example, the life table. But let me just point out, since we're getting into some of the concepts here, what I find exciting, partly, is among many things, is the way in which this very embodied daily way of living opens out into justice. It opens into spirituality. It requires communal life together, right? I mean, it highlights, it points beyond the individualism of our culture, right? It potentially carries, we always speak when we eat in Christian churches also, you know, word and meal go together. So it carries opportunities for conversation and for passing on language and story as well. And then, from this one practice, points into all the other practices. You have to have time. You have to, you care about the body. You care about. So it kind of becomes, and you could do that with any of them, actually. Yeah. Any practice points to all the others finally. Okay. So we'll go into that one more fully on Thursday. But it's a great example of how concrete and yet how global and traditioned this understanding of practice is, right? And the spirituality and justice, I think, constantly merged as well. So, Jonathan Wilson Hartfield, thank you.
Yeah, like I said, I live in a place called the Rootba House in Durham, North Carolina. Rootba is the name of a little town in Iraq. My wife and I were there at the beginning of the present war with the Christian peacemaker teams, and we got kicked out, but that's a whole other story. But at any rate, because we got kicked out, we had to drive through the western desert of Iraq while they were still bombing. So, you know, you got F-16s flying over, and you see dust clouds coming up, and the driver says, let's go. So we're driving really fast. And there were three cars, and the one in the back, we got to a point and it didn't meet us, so we had to go back. And we realized that they had a wreck. But what had happened was some Iraqis had picked up our friends who were in this car accident and taken them to this town called Rootba. And when they got there, the doctor said to them, 3 days ago, your country bombed our hospital, but we'll take care of you because we take care of everyone. And he sewed up their heads and saved two of their lives. And so when we got there, we heard the story, and we asked the doctor, you know, what in the world can we do to repay you? And he said, oh, nothing. Just please tell the world what happened in Rootba. So we came back to the United States having had that experience. And I mean, talk about connecting it to the stories, that, you know, I mean, we had that experience and we said, well, my God, we just had a Good Samaritan experience, you know? I mean, that's the story. The enemy's on the roadside and gets saved. That's what it means to love your neighbor. So we were trying to figure out, well, boy, you know, after you have an experience like that, how do you go on? We decided to move to Durham and to start a house that we named after the town Rootba, the Rootba House. It would be a house of hospitality and peacemaking and discipleship, we said. So we've been doing that for a couple years now. Our life there, I would say, to kind of segue from you, is a lot about the common table. And we often get folks who come by and say, boy, we've never really known, this experience of sitting down and eating together. So people that have come to live with us or just our neighbors sometimes just stop by because there's a table there where there's food and there's conversation going on. And so I think that's one practice that's been really important for us and is a big part of our hospitality. We open our door to folks who want to come and eat with us. And then as space is available to people who need a place to live. And so we've really gotten to experience other people's lives and exchange in a way that I think is a great grace to us. I think people are always expressing gratitude on the other side too. So there's an exchange going on there that I think we're all grateful for. The project that I've done with the Valparaiso project is on taking this way of life that we've discovered in our community, that we feel like we've really been given in our community, and that a lot of friends of ours who are in other similar communities have also experienced, and trying to connect that to the tradition that we're really part of. And so we've called it a new monasticism. We've said, you know, look at the history of the church, and you see that there are periods of crisis in which the church always kind of finds a new future, and it's usually in a kind of monastic movement. So, you know, you look at Constantinianism and how the desert fathers and mothers went out and started this new way of life in the desert. And, you know, it's right at the peak of the Crusades when Francis goes out, as Dan was telling us the other day, and starts a new movement. And so we said, boy, you know, I mean, some folks are saying it's the end of history, you know, we're living in the last remaining superpower and all this stuff, and maybe, you know, the Spirit's stirring to start a new monasticism. So we got together and talked about that, and some friends who we had known for a while and some other folks that we had heard about and just sort of gathered together and had a really powerful experience of sharing with one another what our lives are like and realizing that there are some marks of this way of life that we're discovering that are similar. So we called them 12 marks of a new monasticism, and we were grateful for money to get some people together to write about those marks. And so we did this book. Got a copy of it here. Here's my pitch. This is called Schools for Conversion, 12 Marks of a New Monasticism. And so each of the marks that we laid out has a chapter in here. And it's an attempt to describe how this is connected to the scriptures and to the tradition of the church. And also it just tells a lot of stories about what this looks like in different places. So if I have time, I'll tell a couple stories. How long do we have here? Here's one of my favorite stories. There's a woman in Philadelphia. Her name's Sister Margaret McKenna. She's in her mid-70s now. But Sister Margaret, she did a PhD at UPenn a long time ago. And she studied the Desert Fathers and Mothers. When she was done, she had this like she was offered a book contract to have her dissertation that she'd worked up in like 6 books or something. It was a huge project that she could have spent a long time working on. And she said, you know, I just don't know if I want to do that. She said, I think I'd like to try to live what I've learned from the Desert Fathers and Mothers. So she went to Jerusalem and went out into the Judean desert and just lived there for 7 years. And after that, she said, I think it's time to go back to the deserts of the United States. So she wrote a chapter in here called The Deserts I Have Known. And it's really powerful how she tells the story of coming back eventually to Philadelphia and to this abandoned neighborhood in North Philadelphia and realizing this is a desert. This is an abandoned place. And God is calling us here to do something. And so she went there, and she just started she had a few friends from her order, the Medical Mission Sisters, and they just started a little praying community there, and then they realized that their only neighbors were addicts. And so they decided that they really needed to be a recovery community. But not just kind of a recovery program where, you know, some people who have it together help other folks. But she said she says it was kind of like a primitive Benedictinism, you know, where you have these wandering people who aren't sure what their life's about, and we all get together, and she says we started discovering that we were all addicted to stuff, and that what we all really needed was a reformation of manners, a reordering of our way of life. And so they have this new monastic community there where people live together, lots of them trying to recover from their addiction to drugs, some people trying to recover from their addictions to money and to power and to academic prestige, and they live together there.
Sugar.
yeah, lots of different things.
Coffee.
Yeah, so That's one of the beautiful stories that's come out. One more story about how I think we've learned that the lives that we're living are tied to our traditions and to the really the local congregations that are always carrying on these stories and passing on practices. About a year ago in our neighborhood, there was a gang fight on the corner and a guy got killed just down the street from our house. There's a African-American Baptist church across the street where my wife and I worship on Sunday mornings. And so so we, in conversation with this church, just said, what are we going to do? And we decided that every Saturday we would go out and pray, which I thought, it's a big thing. I mean, activists would call this like a vigil, right? When somebody gets killed or you have some violence, you do a vigil. So we did this, but what happened was, our brothers and sisters from the church got out there, and all they knew how to do together was have church. So we just had church. I mean, they just started singing the same songs and started praying the same kind of prayers out there on the streets. I think because of that's what they've been practicing,
Yeah.
And it was really powerful thing to have this church walking through the streets singing the same songs that we sing every Sunday, but thinking, boy, what does it mean now that we're out here on the street facing violence, what does it mean to say, what a mighty God we serve? I think it was a beautiful expression of how the church can come to a point where you really realize, oh, we've been practicing for this.
Right.
This is what we're doing in the world.
That's a great example. And you're doing it in the world as well as in the church. And that's a great example of what we hope for.
Jonathan, I appreciate what you just shared, and that sometimes the practices of why we're doing it becomes known after the fact. That we say, well, yeah, we have this inkling or this hunch that we should go out and pray or go out and do something.
Right.
And then lo and behold, oh my gosh, so this is what we were arriving at or going towards. And I guess the beautiful thing is what Dorothy, that what we say we believe, we become.
Right. Right. Any other comments before we go to Matt, which is a whole other interesting angle on this? One of the words that one of our authors and practicing our faith, Greg Jones, who likes to use this, when we're working with practices, we craft them. You've kind of got your raw materials there.
Yeah.
These people, this place, this community, not some other. And knowing what we know from the tradition, all kinds of reflection, but seeing where we are right here, how we craft these so that we're not laying down some universal thing on any given community, but rather working with its own specificity. To help build something beautiful, or to disclose the beauty that's already there. Any other comments? We ask Matt to add in, and then we can all keep talking. Okay? Matt, Matt Davis. Matt Smith from Davis.
Yes, my name's Matt Smith.
Matt Smith from Davis.
I live in Davis, California, and I'm a minister there with children and youth at a United Methodist Church. And I arrived there about this time last year, and one of the things that you first see when you arrive as a person who's going to work with children and youth are all of the things that the other people who've worked with children and youth have left behind. And you quickly find in youth ministry that you're inundated with materials about how you ought to entertain children and youth. And we have piles and piles. Even if you just come for a couple of weeks, you could stack the material on top of one another and have boxes to entertain yourself. Just ways that people are struggling, trying to offer for us to keep our children and our youth entertained through the year. So I arrived to that material and also started to spend time with the young people in the community, just kind of on a one-on-one basis, and started to recognize that some of the young people in this community are drawn to cooking themselves. I think they might actually be out here on staff in the future. I could see them cooking here at Holden. a couple of young people in particular who have started this program at their school where they prepare meals once a week. They make breakfast for people. They're short order cooks and they are wonderful chefs. So I was talking to them about their work, and also at the same time I had met Don Richter and was being introduced to another project called Youth Ministry and Spirituality Project that really focuses on slowing down, on youth ministry as a practice of slowing down. And as I was thinking together with the young people about their work in food and about my past experiences with community organizing and with refugee resettlement and with this kind of movement toward contemplative practices, together we came up with this possibility of a cafe. So we have, they're in Davis, California, and Davis is a university town. So we have lots of young people whose families are involved at the university, lots of young people who are going off to Stanford and to Cal and to NYU, and are overwhelmed with pressure to succeed at school. So it seemed important that one of the elements of our youth program be simply slowing down to reflect on ourselves as children of God. And that was something that young people, as they experience the pressure to succeed and succeed and succeed, don't find all the time. So we started to kind of piece these things together and came up with this idea of a cafe. And what we've basically done is we have a couple of college students that work with our youth, and we have a couple of family parents who come together for an hour every time before our youth gather on Sunday evenings. And we're together in contemplative prayer for about an hour, praying together about the young people that are involved in our program, about the young people in the wider Davis community, and about young people around the world. We're there together for about an hour, and then our young people start to arrive. And basically, over the next hour and a half, we share food together. Three times or four times in some months, we simply make, as Marie has talked about them this week, special treats. Marie's special treats are lollipops or watermelons sometimes. Our young people make special treats both for themselves, and we come together in similar ways to the way that people prepare food out here at Holden. We come together with whole ingredients, with organic foods, to join together around a table, as both of these have. We also are in ministry, our church is in ministry to a homeless community in our area. And so our young people prepare the same treats that we share together, are also prepared as gifts to the homeless adults who gather at our church on Mondays for rest and respite. Once a month, as we gather together, we prepare a full meal together and then also gift a full meal to the folks who gather at our ministry, our outreach ministry to homeless adults. And we close every time with about 20 or 30 minutes of contemplative prayer and music together. And prayer on the cross, which I believe we'll do later this week,
Friday,
was really central to us throughout Lent. That was our first experience. The young people in this church, it was their first experience with prayer on the cross. And what we found, what I believe we're finding as we practice this together, and we've just been doing it for a little less than a year now, is space. Space to reveal who we are and to discern where God might be inviting us as young people. These are young people who have scripts that they're given. They're going to be very successful. And what we're hoping and what I believe is happening in the church right now is the church together as a community is providing just some space that the young people can find alternative scripts. The script that they're given isn't necessarily the one that they have to follow, but that there are new possibilities that they can find together with other people in community. One of the things that we came across as we were doing this, we started out, there's a, I believe they call it Emily's test in here. And Emily invites you to think back through all of the food that you've consumed in the last day and kind of chart who it's related to and where it's come from. And see, just by the food that you've eaten, how deeply interwoven and connected you are to creation and to other people. So we kind of started in that place, and at the same time we were looking at a church in Houston that has a McDonald's on its premises. And so our young people really started to think together about the alternative of fast food being fair and slow and messy sometimes. And so we find ourselves gathering on Sundays around a hope for fairness and slowing down, and that's always messy. I believe where we're moving in the future is connecting our youth ministry program with our work around Gandhi Play and our children's ministry, and then also inviting our adults in our community to practice these things intentionally as we move together as well. One of the things about Way to Live, it's very intentional that this is something young people and adults do together. It's not youth ministry with one person out there who's really hip and cool and can entertain young people, but it really is about a community process. And I think we've started to create a little bit of space that's beginning to happen kind of across our ministry.
The same Emily will arrive tomorrow and join our group. She's 22 and just graduated from college on Sunday.
Was that listed in the book?
It's actually in there. It's in there, and then there's also, along with this, there's also a leader's guide.
Don and I did Way to Live together, and all this is in the book's part, but we, with a couple of other people, we developed a leader's guide, which has just, it's 142 pages and has a whole lot of ideas, but including for every practice. Susan Briel is coming tomorrow with a psalm prayer, and there's Lexio Divina texts for every practice, as well as very experiential ways of reflecting on this practice in one's own life. Yeah.
And one of the things I think this does differently than most resources that you receive for children and youth is with that, you're, as a youth minister, I simply give that to someone else to go and entertain the children and youth, and you have stickers that you put in places, or you have things that you're supposed to. It actually like tells you, say this. And what this provides is a framework, and it gives you a space to begin, and it gives you space to start with. And what we found is we've stayed with the practice of food and justice and music and prayer. Those four, I mean, and others kind of weave together with them, obviously, but it's not something that you take and you read once and then you mimic it to children and youth. It really does recognize the humanity of and the possibility of young people because it's not rote. It's grounding.
And actually, part of our motive in doing this book was to serve young people, but also adults will often get drawn into more intentional participation in life of faith because they care about their children. And also because being parents discloses them their own vulnerability and inadequacy, you know, which draws us also to Christ, you know. So, it's very much always together with adults and youth. And
I just want to tag off the People Into Mission congregation that's very young, as in the congregation is not very old. It's a wide range of people, but to try to build a sense of community, we have several small groups, and there is no youth program, so our group was intergenerational.
Uh-huh.
And our daughter, the youngest was about 10, and the oldest member was about 7 or 8. And the first thing that we used as the basis for our conversation was Way to Live.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a wonderful tool for having using as an intergenerational discussion, and it also was helpful in terms of moving out to serve and also to share my plan.
This is available free on the website, by the way.
It takes a lot of ink, though.
Yeah,
it takes a lot of patience.
Yeah.
I'd be interested in that. How do you do the contemplative prayer? There's different kind of forms.
Yeah, we've done it a variety of different ways. And when we first started out, I have very limited gifts in music. So I'm very fortunate to work with a lot of young people who have amazing gifts in music. So we begin, really the only thing that's consistent ritually from week to week is we begin singing the song Sanctuary together and close with What Does the Lord Require of You? And so kind of both of those songs frame our time together. And then beyond that, we have kind of a team of young people that's developing, both in our high school group and in our junior high group, I work together with them. So for a while we did, we often do Lexio Divina, we probably do that at least once or twice a month. We do awareness examine together. We've done some really fun kind of coloring exercises where young people are kind of invited to, and we've done it with chalk, with paint, with all kinds of, inviting young people to think about where they've experienced themselves most open to the presence of God or most closed to the presence of God in the last week. So kind of, it changes from week to week, and it's becoming more driven by youth leading that, but it wasn't initially there.
There's been several questions as we work with this material about the place of what someone calls spiritual disciplines within the life of practice that we are trying to advocate. And so in practicing our faith, for example, prayer and Bible study were not included, or worship as practices. I think that was probably a mistake. But the rationale was that what we're really trying to get at is a way of life in the world, and that spiritual disciplines are the are disciplines that enable us to see God's presence in all of that, that focus our attention and help us to see, rather than being in themselves what we're about in the world. And that we'll talk more about that on Thursday, but that we need to, clearly we need to, human beings need to learn to settle ourselves and offer better attention to what's going on around us. And spiritual disciplines definitely do that. So, for instance, I would talk about practice of like a table or breaking bread, and feast and fasting might be a spiritual discipline that would help us to be more attentive to what's going on there, but not in itself be a whole practice. That's how I think about it. But it is kind of, you know, a specialized way of thinking. But the spiritual disciplines are a very important part of the life of faith we're describing. So, yeah, Mike.
Matt, I was wondering, you mentioned community organizing at the beginning. What, how do you see community organizing informing what you're doing?
Well, I work now in Davis, which is a very privileged town. It's predominantly white and very affluent. And so I've had worked for the last 2 years, though, in the South Bronx, working with young people and organizing there. And so one of the experiences that I've had is just how it seems very obvious as we gather young people together in the South Bronx about what the issues are that we need to work together around. When I gather young white folks of privilege together to talk about what are the issues in our town, we kind of did a lot of blank stares. And then after a few moments of silence, people tend to talk about how kind of good they have it there. So the inclination then is to jump to somewhere else. Well, then we're going to go do a mission trip in Mexico. We're going to go do a mission trip in someplace else and help the people that we objectify over in that space, and then come back to our place. So community organizing for me has just given me a lens to think about how is it that what we're doing together with young people all the time is organizing, whether they see it or not, or a lack of organizing too often. But for us, then, it's a matter of how do we come back together and continue coming back together so that we can locate some of the issues that are of concern in our immediate area and connect those to wider issues. So kind of the process to us led to this ministry with homeless adults in our community. It's also led us over to Sacramento to work with this organization called Spirit in the Arts that's doing organizing around arts and activism. And I really do believe that the coming together around contemplative prayer is what's made space for some of that to happen. I don't believe that our young people or that the adults in our community were attentive to those possibilities within their own community without that time of slowing down and reflecting and moving deeply in relationship with each other and God. So I guess that's a lens.
It's interesting that there might be a way in which, I mean, I like your metaphor of organizing within the because in a sense, you might even make the argument coming back to Jonathan's Sister Margaret's story of there are deserts in our country.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's ironic, but you could make the argument that there are deserts exist even among affluents and affluent communities of no community and no places where people would feel welcomed or hospitality. And so that's a very real task that needs doing.
And I think one of the things I think Nancy has pointed to this week, Islam has pointed to this week that's been helpful, is not collapsing those all down together too, because the deserts that we find in Davis, California are different than the deserts that you experience there. So one of the things that I hope we're doing with our young people in our church is really helping them to touch the depths of what's happening in their own lives, that when they do go out, when they are in other places and they experience different forms of racism or abject poverty, that they're attentive to that, the empathetic hope that Nancy used this week. Locating ourselves in our own place seems critical to be open to that possibility.
Well, I think we need to end the formal part of the session. I'm willing to hang around and talk if anybody wants to, and we'll see each other through the week. Please, all of you, let's continue it in other ways beyond the session, okay? Thank you very much.